Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Welcome to Handy Link, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Segment of our show, we'll hear from Timothy Spaulding from Freedom 424. He'll be telling us about individuals with disabilities as victims of human trafficking. So tell me a little bit about Freedom 424 and how their work can benefit a person with a disability.
Sure, yeah. So Freedom 424 is a nonprofit organization based out of Lynchburg, Virginia. And we work all over the world. And you know, really, we were started back in 2009 by a college student, a girl named Christine. She still sits on our board. She had gone to Thailand for an internship. And this was with an organization working in the red light districts of Bangkok and working with women who were being exploited and trafficked, and came back to school and just said, I need to do something. And so, you know, her something was, let's raise some funds and let's start helping. And really, we've expanded since then. And, you know, our mission is to bring freedom and justice to victims and survivors of trafficking. And we do that by raising awareness and raising funds to partner with frontline organizations who are working to end modern slavery. And so, you know, it's an interesting thing, you know, I think on its face, you know, just at a first glance, you may not necessarily think that our work necessarily dovetails with disabilities and people with disabilities. But, you know, what we have seen and what I've seen is, you know, there's a lot of factors that go into trafficking. And people say, you know, hey, what's the profile of trafficking? I mean, there really is none, because there's just so many different factors that come into play, whether it's poverty, whether it's problems at home, whether it's, you know, whatever it may be. One of the things that we continue to see in the research and just in the anecdotal evidence is, you know, people with some kind of a disability tend to be, you know, having a disability is one of those things that is one of those exacerbating factors. So, you know, that's really kind of a, I guess, where the intersect is, you know, between our work as an anti-trafficking organization and people with disabilities.
So, for Freedom 424, what are some of the greatest challenges you see?
You know, one of the greatest challenges that we face is really on the awareness and the funding side. You know, this I feel like it in the national consciousness in the United States, and I would say in Canada as well. My wife's Canadian, from Ottawa, and, you know, so we've got some strong ties there. And, you know, I would just say even in the West as a whole, is an awareness and understanding of trafficking and what that looks like. You know, a lot of times we have this view that it's, you know, this Hollywood view that it's the, you know, the panel van that comes by with no windows and, you know, grabs somebody, throws them in, and then they're locked up for the rest of their lives as a, you know, being trafficked. And certainly it happens in a few cases, but the vast majority don't really look like that. And so it's helping people understand that, you know, you might be observing trafficking victims at, you know, at a hotel, at a truck stop, at a this, that, you know, even with teachers, you know, you have some students who are being trafficked while still living at home. It's something that's happening after school before they go home and eat dinner and do their, you know, their algebra homework. So, you know, really the public awareness and understanding of what trafficking is and what it looks like, especially in a North American context, is one of those, is definitely a hurdle. And then, you know, the flip side is also funding. I think that's a big challenge for for any nonprofit, but especially with anti-trafficking organizations. You know, when you're talking about victim services and coming alongside and assisting there, you're talking about having trained professionals with, you know, with advanced university degrees, whether that's in counseling or law or psychology, and you know, so there's no way around it, but it's expensive work.
So, in your time with the organization, have there been any successes as far as public awareness?
Sorry, say that again?
In your time with the agency, has there been any success moment in terms of public awareness?
Yeah, so, you know, I can't point to any one particular instance, but what we are, I can look back over my 3.5 years and say that we have continued to see growth in the awareness side of things. One of the things that we've done is kind of a dual fundraising and awareness effort is we host 5K races across the country. We've got them in the Northeast, California, Virginia, Maryland, Pennsylvania, Colorado, all over. And it's a really neat way to galvanize a community. You know, it's an activity that a lot of people are enjoying, whether it's walking or running. And, you know, you pull a lot of people together. And so you can raise a lot of funds from, you know, smaller amounts from a lot of people, and you can still get there. But also just the awareness piece of that. You know, we've seen more and more where, you know, following a race, someone comes up invariably saying, hey, you know, I knew a little bit of what you guys did, but I didn't realize the extent of how it affects me and how it affects my community. And so, you know, really seeing just a continued awareness growing is a huge success. And for me, it's not even awareness is kind of a twofold thing. You know, the way I look at it is, you know, if people become aware but they don't do anything about it, you know, it's kind of half-baked, if you will. Awareness for the sake of awareness really doesn't accomplish anything. But when you have someone who can turn that awareness into action, whether that is being proactive in sharing in their school, in their community, or fundraising, whatever it may be, you know, that's when we really see the real value, is when it's gone from a head to a heart and people say, okay, so what's my role in this? What can I do? That's about the biggest win that I can think of.
So in terms of the victims themselves, individuals with disabilities or people from different ethnic backgrounds, if you think about it, these are just people with families and hopes and dreams, and, well, public awareness really does play a role into this, just recognizing that they're not some statistic.
Yeah. You know, my wife's background is in special education and educational psychology. She's a university professor in that field, and you know, a lot of her research is kind of dovetailed into that, and we've done some work together on that. And really, it's, you know, we work internationally and domestically, and our partners internationally, you know, we've seen a lot of times in, say, a country like India, where you've got, a survivor who has physical disabilities, whether that's, you know, someone being mute or deaf. And in those instances, you know, we've seen a few instances where someone is being, you know, exploited and abused, and they don't really have a means of communicating that. You also have other situations where, you know, someone may be seen as lesser than in, say, a developing country context, where, you know, a family has a bunch of kids. You know, these are the children that have some more difficulties. We have to pick and choose. And so we certainly see that. But domestically as well, you know, when we look at, you know, the incidences of learning disabilities and to some extent physical disabilities among trafficking survivors, you know, there isn't a lot of studies being done. I still think it's a lot of it's just coming to the consciousness, but and you have a lot of practitioners, not necessarily researchers, in the field, but we see that continuously. You know, someone who's has a learning disability and is struggling in school, or physical disabilities and struggling in school, struggling to find a way to fit into society, finding a you know, friends to fit in with, and you know, ultimately, it's, you know, when we see, or I should say, that just tends to be a really recurring factor with victims and survivors that I've spoken with. You know, talking about the traffickers themselves, they're looking for people with a vulnerability, whether that's, you know, an emotional need, a physical need, whatever it may be. That's ultimately what they're looking for. I'm thinking of one woman in particular who lives on the West Coast of the United States now. she was trafficked for a few years around the United States and Canada. And she said, you know, the guy who recruited me was at a mall. And, you know, he'd throw out comments to 100 girls a day. Hey, you look good. You look pretty, this, that. And they're not looking for the girl that blows them off, but they're looking for the one who turns around and says, really, you think so? And basically they're trying to say, where is a need? Where is something that, you know, how can I exploit somebody? How can I get that hook? And, you know, oftentimes, I know you'd see this as well, but, you know, people with disabilities can be marginalized in society. And when you have that situation, that can create a vulnerability, that can create a desire for belonging and community and so forth and so on if someone's not necessarily finding it elsewhere. So that to me is that biggest piece where it all fits together.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
My friends, this may be one of the most pressing issues surrounding individuals with disabilities, as well as other members of the community. Fact is, this kind of exploitation, which may start off seeming to be a relationship, is not acceptable. A lot of these traffickers do start off on the principle getting to know the victim, forming a connection, forming a relationship, and little by little, it turns into something completely co-opted. Fact of the matter is, things of this nature are unjustified and wrong. But for all those out there making a difference for those being trafficked who are being exploited, I salute them. For the fact is, there is always the possibility of a better life. Even in situations as horrifying as that, hope does exist in the world. It's agencies like this one that are really proving this. Fact of the matter is, a person must have the courage to say, this is wrong and I deserve better. That's where it all begins. That can lead to seeking for the right help, the right hope. Never face these matters on your own. Never believe you are alone. There are people out there who can help. HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
Considered one of the world's top jazz pianists, Patrice Rochen has performed with and produced for esteemed artists such as Stevie Wonder, Herbie Hancock, Prince, Carlos Santana, Tom Jones, Michael Jackson, and many more. She has multiple Grammy nominations and has played at some of the world's most prestigious jazz festivals. On Wednesday, July 13th at 7:30 p.m., Ms. Rochen brings her magic hands to the superb confines of Shane Park. Opening for Patrice Rochen is Detroit bassist Jerome Yancey. Tickets are available at the Shane Park box office or visit chenepark.detroit.com.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard from Timothy Spaulding from Freedom 424. In this segment of our show, we'll hear a little bit about abuse and disability. I'll be chatting with Mike Sultana from Hiatus House. So tell me how mental health can play a role in disability issues as far as people who might make use of Hiatus House.
Okay, it's a good question, Cam. Women with disabilities who have been abused, are affected, you know, by abuse of all kinds. And when we're talking about abuse, Cam, we're looking at not only physical abuse, and most people equate a violence against women with physical abuse, but we're looking at psychological, emotional abuse, sexual abuse, abuse of property and pets, and all these forms of abuse on victims of domestic violence, whether they are disabled or abled individuals, can have a powerful impact on their mental health, and can lead to all kinds of issues in terms of related with trauma and related with low self-esteem. Basically, sometimes women who are abused are thinking about ruminating about suicide, you know, killing themselves as a way of a means of escaping the situation. We find women who are abused sometimes resort to alcohol or drugs to self-medicate themselves in from the trauma, from what they're experiencing. And there's, you know, all kinds of other factors when it comes to mental health that come into play. We find that many women who are abused blame themselves for the abuse. It's like they, on some level, think that they're responsible for that and should be able to end the abuse by their partner. Now, women with disabilities, I mean, compounded on top of, you know, all of the so-called, you know, regular impacts and symptoms that we see in victims who are being abused, who are not disabled. I mean, women with disabilities oftentimes suffer from, you know, an additional, an added burden of psychological difficulties. Sometimes women with disabilities, women who are abused with disabilities, they not only blame themselves for the violence, but they blame themselves for their disability. You know, they think somehow they're responsible for that, and you know, they're stuck in this situation, and somehow on some level it's their fault. And, you know, women with disabilities are, you know, many are suffering from, you know, the impacts of a form of prejudice in our society in terms of being seen by some, maybe more than some people in our society, as almost less than human, like not as valued as abled people. You know, and that can lead to, you know, significant impacts in terms of how they see themselves, their self-esteem, in terms of, you know, the way other people see them. Sometimes they'll see themselves in that same way. So mental health is certainly an issue here.
So can you tell me a little bit about some of the recourse options someone affected with a disability and in an abusive situation might have?
Sure. That's a good question. Well, at Hiatus House here in Windsor, it's a shelter for abused women and their children. We've been around since 1976, 42 beds, I don't know if I said that or not. The building is, so women who are abused, disabled women who are abused, for instance, have access to all of the services in the shelter, and we are fully accessible. For instance, Cam, we have our building is wheelchair accessible. We have wheelchair accessible bedrooms and bathrooms. You know, we have TTY specialized telephones, you know, to accommodate, you know, sensory impaired women. We provide sign language and interpreter services. So, I mean, the shelter is a temporary fix, if you want to call it that. On average, I think women are probably in the shelter for about 21 days or so. And while they're in the shelter, we would work with them, intervene with them in terms of what it is that they want for themselves, right? In terms of how they want to move forward. And so we provide counseling in the shelter. We provide other forms of services in terms of referrals to legal services, central housing registry if they want to relocate and separate from their partners. Women with intellectual disabilities, for instance, we would sometimes refer them to the CMHA, the Canadian Mental Health Association. There's also an organization in Windsor in this area called the Regional Support Association, who serve women with intellectual and developmental disabilities, and they provide clinical supports. So all of those are available to women in the shelter. Also, Cam, on lower level in Hiatus House, an area that I directly supervise here is the kind of the community outreach component of what we do here in terms of clients in the community who are seeking counseling therapy for you know, the impacts of domestic violence. And so we have a program on lower level here called the Women's Fresh Start Program for women who are voluntary, who want to seek those counseling therapy services. And so those are available also to women who are, you know, disabled. And I know we have elevators in the building, so if a woman wants to come up, come through the upstairs, the level, the street level, you know, there'd be a way for her to get downstairs to fresh start and to get out of the building and all of that. So so those are some of the services. I'm sure I'm not covering all of them. We do a lot here, well regarded, I believe, in the community by you know, community partners.
So do you typically see success in the work you do? Would someone suffering from this sort of abuse who comes to you, would they typically find a better path?
Yeah, that's a good question too. Well, success is it can be defined or seen in all kinds of ways from different angles. Women who come into the shelter, Cam, about 30% of those women, whether abled or disabled, leave the shelter and go back to their abusive partners, either in a planned or unplanned kind of way. And I was talking with Genevieve Ishek. She's the clinical director of Fresh Start Services upstairs. She's the person who manager who actually supervises staff in the shelter. Again, I'm supervise the community counseling outreach programs. I was chatting with her, talking with her yesterday, and she was saying, you know, with disabled women who have been abused or in the shelter, we would probably see a higher, more than 30% of those women go back to abusive partners. There seem to be a number of other factors in play, like, again, compounding the domestic violence issues that all women would be bringing into the shelter. Women who are disabled, sometimes are believe that they're very dependent on their partners to provide care and assistance for them. And there's all kinds of fears in terms of that kind of separation, in terms of what happens to her financially. Sometimes abusive men, partners of women who are disabled, threatened with them with institutionalization and whatnot. So, as far as the other 70% of women, they are moving on in terms of relocating, getting new housing, getting legal assistance, looking at a permanent type of separation from their abusive partners. And just as an aside here, we know that when women are separating from their partner, they're probably at the highest risk or higher risk for more abuse. Sometimes we've been looking at, homicide here in terms of what he's threatening if she was to leave him. Now we have, we call it recidivism, and I don't quite like that word, but we have women who are in the shelter and they stay with us for a while, and we provide them with services, and they go back to their partners, that 30% or more, and then they come back into the shelter, right, later on. It could be the next day, it could be a month from now or a year from now. And, you know, and some people would look at that, Cam, and say, well, you know, that probably means you're not being very successful. But we tend to look at it another way, in that usually when women are in the shelter and then they return to an abusive partner and come back, usually it's they're coming back at a point where perhaps the abuse in the interim, in the space between when they left and when they've returned, has not become as severe. They're recognizing the warning signs. They realize there is recourse for them. There is some place for them to go where they can get help. So a woman returning who has left and returned to an abusive partner, comes back to the shelter, that's a good thing, right? With counseling services, we have long-term therapy services here for women. And we believe that women in the Fresh Start program, which in the primary goal of the Women's Fresh Start program is for women to take responsibility for their physical and psychological safety, we believe that women on average need to be in the program about a year and a half to 2 years to make significant changes in that primary goal. Now, I haven't even begun to talk about the services that we offer here to men who are abusive, including men who are the partners of women who are disabled, who those men are sometimes have some kind of a disability themselves too. So we work with those men too in the Men's Fresh Start program, a voluntary program providing therapy. And the primary goal of the men's program is for them to take responsibility for their physical and psychological abuse of partner and to end that violence. And the same kind of timeline here, about a year and a half to 2 years to make significant changes in terms of that primary goal that I mentioned, to take responsibility for their abuse and end it. And, you know, we do see changes in men who attend counseling therapy consistently, you know, on a regular basis, once a week, a couple hours a session. And that program has been around since 1981, right? So we've been doing this for a while.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec. It's true that for someone in a disability abusive relationship, the temptation can be to say, this is all I have, this is the best I can do. But the fact is, it's just settling, and it's not the right thing for anyone. By the same token, a person, an able-bodied person, can also reverse exploit a person with a disability by doing the things they know full well their partner can do. It's the same, in my mind, as saying, you're not good enough to do this on your own, so I'm just going to do it for you without letting you try. That, too, is a form of exploitation. We've all known that someone who is in a relationship that just isn't right. You hope and you pray that they find the right way of things. But there is absolutely no justification for exploiting or abusing someone with a disability. What's worse still, you get into an abusive relationship, in some cases that can actually cause a psychological disability. Someone could go in and be perfectly quote-unquote normal and end up with the wrong person, get mistreated, end up with a long-term stress disorder. Just thinking, taking a perfectly valid, wonderful, beautiful life, as all life is, and saying, it doesn't matter, you're not worth it. You don't deserve equality or respect. Who are we in society to make that kind of call? In society today, we all feel the need to rush in terms of relationships. Take the first, easiest answer to come along, without necessarily considering, is it the right one? Do we really think so little of ourselves that we would just take anything that seems like a relief to our own loneliness? A balanced relationship, my friends, is one where a person doesn't ask or take too much of one partner, and the other doesn't feel the drain of having all their needs not met. In a relationship, the primary need is love and acceptance. And hopefully, if you're very lucky, a relationship will force you to grow, to ask the questions you never did before, to become something not different than you were before, necessarily, but just a more enlightened person. For a person with a disability in any sort of relationship, it should be one where they're given a chance to shine with their own strength, but also to contribute equally as a partner, a colleague, a friend. A relationship that is balanced, that brings two people together in honest love, not one where a person says, I could do this myself, but I'm just going to rely too heavily on somebody else. Relationships are a gift, but they are not something to be co-opted, not something that we convince ourselves is the right answer. To do so just takes the shine out of it, folks. It just gets us to a place where we believe that we don't matter enough to really be loved or considered. That is never how it should be with anybody, whether they have a disability or not. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal, So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.